Word about me first. I'm one of the co-founders of Ivan, which is a database as a service company. We operate in pretty much all the public clouds, and previously I used to work on large-scale databases and distributed systems. I'm also the maintainer for a bunch of open source projects, mostly around Postgres. These days, not that active anymore, but still doing something every now and then when time permits. Then a word about Ivan, just so you know where we're coming from. We basically are a company that operates databases globally in six different cloud providers in 89 different regions around the world. There's eight different open source data engines or messaging systems that we provide. And we started off in early 2016 by providing a managed Postgres service. While we are not like a hyperscaler like Google or AWS, we still operate at a pretty fierce scale. Some definitions before we get into the meat of the matter. Stateful systems, they typically hold important things, namely the state of your system. That is what also makes them slightly different from stateless systems, which are really easy to restart, really easy to move around. This is, by the way, where typically systems like Kubernetes have been at their strongest, as in like stateless systems, you can easily just stop or restart or have start running in a pod somewhere else. But in the case of stateful systems, there's plenty of data, and the more data you have, the harder it gets to actually manage them. There's also lots of considerations around durability and accidental changes to the data, and what those are the kind of things that you really don't want to see happening accidentally. As for immutable infrastructure, it's basically a paradigm where servers, once they're actually running, they are never actually changed afterwards. Basically, the idea behind this is to make your deployments more consistent and reliable because you're always doing it the same way. So historically, if people deployed a service and then they went manually to change something in the configuration, eventually, if you had, let's say, 100,000 machines, none of them actually looked the same as the others. So while there have been lots of different deployment automation tools for this sort of thing, typically they still start differing over time. In order to do this, I'm going to go through some of the tooling we have, but you pretty much need quite a bit of automation tooling around this, because operating at this at a scale is otherwise kind of hard. Anyway, I'll take us back to like early 2015 when we started writing our platform. Basically, a lot of our team had background in using Debian in different companies where we had worked previously. Basically, Debian at that time had its issues with slow release cycles, and basically because of that, a lot of people were using backported packages. Like we had been backporting tons and tons of things. So one of the things we knew, like out of the gate, was that we really didn't want to backport stuff. At least we didn't want to backport system components, which would have basically meant rebuilding the whole thing. The other thing that we wanted to do is corollary that is basically something that worked really close to the upstream project. So typically that when you made a bug report, actually the stuff would get upstreamed whenever the fix went in. And also back then there was still the hullabaloo around systemd integration into Debian, and like that was something that we actually wanted to use already back then. Debian has a reputation for being stable. I've added this in quotation marks, but I'll get to that later. But it has many positives, as in the open source free software ethos is really strong around that community. There's no single controlling company around Debian. It's basically lots and lots of volunteers. They may be doing it on company dime, but still they're working there as individuals, and there's no single overarching company behind the distribution. Unlike, for example, in Fedora's case, where Red Hat is the prime contributor behind that. In Debian, there's tons and tons of different packages available. There's based on Debian org's front page, they have like 59,000 different packages available. So that would mean that they basically have coverage of pretty much all the free software out there. Not really, but close enough that it doesn't make a difference. Also, there's lots of Debian derivatives, Ubuntu being the most famous one. That basically means that there's a lot of people who know how Debian and Debian derivatives actually work. But anyway, it turns out that Debian is not quite the perfect fit for us. Basically, in the stable, especially back then when earlier Debian release had been few and far between, it meant that basically, you either needed to start backporting stuff, or you'd have to live with the old packages, which we really didn't want to do for various reasons. And once you actually got far enough behind the curve, so you actually needed to start backporting system components, then it really wasn't fun anymore, because then you actually needed to do lots and lots of work that you'd rather have somebody else doing, which was the whole reason for the thing. Also, once you actually go down that path, you're not really running Debian itself, you're actually running a custom distro, which is just fine, no worries there, but the thing is, why did you want to go with the stable system in the first place? Didn't you want the thing to be something that other people have proven and battle-tested over time? Anyway, it was basically, we had really bad experiences on having to do backporting for ages, and we really didn't want to do that anymore. Then the other thing is, like the systemd hullabaloo back in the day, when they were choosing init, like which init system should be the default. Even though systemd was available as a package for quite a while before then, we still felt that the integration wasn't quite there. A lot of the packages still had initv, sysv init scripts there and lacked systemd unit files for some time. And on the whole, it was at the time, it really wasn't that well integrated with systemd, which was definitely something we wanted to use already back then. Then we started looking at the alternatives. So eventually, we basically ended up with Fedora. But there were a couple of others, but the basic Fedora was pretty early on the main contender. Fedora has a 6-month release cycle. Well, that's slipping every now and then, but still 6-month-ish release cycle, which sounded a bit scary for us at first, because that means that we need to be continuously updating, because Fedora supports the current distro release, and then the one before that, and basically the one before that only gets 2 months of overlapping support. So there's you need to at least once a year basically to be thinking of upgrading, and if you don't do that, then you are out of luck as far as it comes to security patches and whatnot. The upside of this is, of course, that everything is fairly fresh. You don't need to backport a lot of stuff, especially you don't need to backport system libraries or system components, which is great because you don't really want to do that. But on the other hand, we as a database service company, we actually still need to build plenty of packages in order to be able to fix customer found bugs or new minor releases of things or whatnot. But there's basically tons of things that we still need to package. But instead of it being thousands of packages, now we're left with 150 or so packages, which is great. Basically, it sounded like something we wanted to go with. And the other thing was that I mentioned about systemd. Systemd has been in Fedora for quite a while for obvious reasons, it's also well integrated, and it's basically been the default for quite some time, and it really works fairly well. Another, by the way, anecdotal thing is my Pulse Audio setup on Debian never worked, but it worked out of the box on Fedora, so there's that. But anyway, it's not quite related to us choosing Fedora. Well, sort of. The RPM spec files, the way you build RPM packages, it's much, much nicer than building Debian packages. This is my personal opinion, but it's really take that to the bank. That's true. But I really recommend building RPM specs rather than actually doing it the Debian way. Of course, there's not one way. There's an official way of doing it in Debian, but there's 10 other ways of creating dev packages too. Anyway, what you get out of the box with Fedora is you get an up-to-date kernel and systemd. With the kernel, by the way, it also gets updated over time, so you're not actually stuck with running whatever was the released version back then, so you're actually running something fairly recent, as in recent being like the kernel release from the last month or so. So you're actually getting fairly fresh stuff. Then systemd support is there out of the box. It really does work well. There haven't been any issues around that, except for a couple of systemd bugs. Then you get the SE Linux, which is also integrated fairly well into the system and works. We haven't really had any issues with that over the years. Then there are the firewalls there, but in general, okay, this is, by the way, a difference to Debian packaging, like philosophy, if you will. When you install Debian package, let's say you install Postgres packages, by default, it actually starts the server and binds it to port X, whatever the default is, and starts that usually is a public interface, and then it starts serving stuff. Of course, at this point, you don't really have any useful configuration for it or anything else, but we much preferred, like when we install a package, it does absolutely nothing until we tell it tell systemd to actually start the thing up. But this is like one nice thing that's usually not mentioned anywhere. Also, these days it has the latest Python, but on the other hand, it has had the latest Python forever, but the version number was just different back then. So we're like a heavily Python using house, so we have lots of code. Well, we have some code using Go and Java and C, but the vast majority, 90-something percent, is Python for us. Anyway, then a word about the topic. So generally speaking, our philosophy on nodes, which by the way, and for this purpose of this talk, are basically either a virtual machine or a bare metal machine. We don't really distinguish between those. Anyway, the idea is that they're disposable. So we don't care if they go away. We expect them to go away en masse around the planet all the time. The other thing is we really don't put any manual effort into any given single node. Basically, we do everything by automation, and that's been the case for quite a while. The other thing is we operate in 6 different public clouds, and they all have different ways of doing things. So, whoopsie. We don't try not to rely on their functionality too much. So we even from things like disk encryption and so forth, we actually use locks for that instead of using the cloud provider's provided functionality. In general, our integration towards the cloud providers is fairly minimalistic. But anyway, this also there's another side of the coin because of the way we do persistence, which I'll go into in a bit, is it allows us to use things like local SSDs. So typically with many of our competitors, what they're using is network SSDs, so EBS volumes or Google's persistent disks or Azure's premium SSDs. But they're all basically, because of the speed of light, they have severe limitations on how well they perform compared to local SSDs that are basically PCI Express NVMe devices that are connected directly to the machine. That gives us some performance benefits. Anyway, the idea behind durability is also that we always have the data somewhere else than the actual node. So the idea behind this is that if the node dies for whatever reason, which they frequently do, it's still not a biggie. Anyway, word about persistence and durability. Anyway, we try not to rely on EBS volumes, persistent disks, or premium SSDs for persistence. You can't easily move them between clouds. So one of our value props is that you can actually move your services with a couple of clicks between clouds. So instead of having a migration project, you can just say that I want my service, which is in AWS EU West 1, move to US East 1 or wherever you want to move it. I'll go further on into the details how we do that. But anyway, since you can't easily move these actual disks that are network attached, we basically solved the issue another way around. But the nice thing is, since we actually are using local SSDs because we're handling the persistence in a slightly different way, is Like here's just some example numbers, but an EBS volume can do roughly 250 megs, let's just go with reads. It's simpler. They have different characteristics for reads and writes, but if you just go with reads, it's basically 250 megs, and then it can do roughly 10K IOPS, from what I remember. Then on another hand, like AWS, the same cloud vendors, i3 machines, which have local SSDs, they can do like north of 2 gigs a second. It's actually closer to 3 gigs a second. And then on read IOPS, you can get into millions range. So it's on a completely different ballpark when it comes to hardware characteristics. Here's an example of how we do persistence for Postgres, for example. So we have a thing called PG Horde, which was originally written by yours truly. It's basically a Postgres backup daemon, which is on GitHub and the second or third most popular one based on GitHub stars for Postgres. Basically what it does, it takes your write ahead log, compresses the data, encrypts it, and then sends it to object store. This basically gives us a bounded data loss window, which is okay, but this is still isn't great. But for all our HA services, basically, the customer gets to choose whether the data is synchronously or asynchronously replicated. So basically, they get to choose how much performance loss are they willing to accept. But basically, with this, you can get arbitrarily low data loss windows depending on a single node loss. Also, since we provision these in all the different cloud vendors, every one of those which has multiple availability zones, we automatically spread the nodes of a given service. So if you have a Kafka cluster or a Postgres service or Elasticsearch cluster, we always split those into multiple AZs. And we also make sure that in the case of clustered systems like Kafka, if you have n copies of a partition, they are always split among the different availability zones automatically. Anyway, our approach to upgrades is basically that we do rolling forward upgrades. So basically, when you have, let's say, a three-node Kafka cluster, let's say a three-node Elasticsearch cluster, what happens is that we, side-by-side those, we create three new virtual machines, replicate the data over, and do a controlled failover without any downtime for the customer. And that's pretty much the way we do all our software upgrades or hardware upgrades. So the same thing is being used, whether you upgrade, let's say you have three machines that all have 8 gigs of memory, a couple of CPUs, and X amount of disk. If you upgrade to a larger plan, what happens is we, again, create the a bunch of new nodes, replicate the data there, and then basically do failovers there. And this happens the same way whether we change between cloud providers, or I mean, if you're moving from AWS US East 1 to Google's South Carolina data center, we basically just use the exact same methodology again and again. So basically, once the actual nodes are up and running, we actually never touch them again. And we also do this at a huge scale. It's been fairly useful to actually have just a single way of doing this. We've had our share of issues with this, but happily there's only one way for us to do any upgrade, so we really rehearse this a lot. Then word about systemd nspawn versus Docker. Basically, Docker comes with its own set of baggage. There are some philosophical things which we disagreed, mostly like having a single process per container. I mean, you can get around it, but still, that's the general tendency. But there are also things like systemd nspawn is actually part of the system that you're already using. It's like already there. It's built in. It's also much more minimalistic and doesn't come with all that much stuff, but it works fairly well. And in the case of how we build images, our container images are basically just directory trees, more or less. I mean, they may come in tarball or compressed format or whatnot, but they're essentially just directory trees. And the other thing is nspawn integrates really well with systemd, which is pretty neat for us because we can then control stuff from outside the container with systemd itself. We use unit files for a lot of things and a lot of different directives in those, and then we use journal D and its structured logging quite a bit. And both have been like really good for us. Then a word about the host machine. The host machine in our case, where we are running our customer service, is also running Fedora. There's also a single container on the same VM or node, so basically bare metal machine or VM. And there's a bunch of things that are running on it. So once we provision a VM, we install our management agent there. Well, the first thing it does, it actually tries to refresh the packages it has. We're basically doing this so that we can have immediate control over any new nodes, even before we build new images, which we do frequently. So we build our images a lot. But on the other hand, if we want to say, let's say that you cannot have version X of Postgres package because we decide that, okay, this one sucks, before we can actually roll it out to 89 different cloud regions around the world, that takes a while. Depending on the cloud vendor, it may take quite a bit of time. So we actually have created this mechanism so just we can, just 5 minutes later, when we create the next node, we can just control specifically what kind of packages is it getting. Typically, there's nothing to do at this step. It's just typically the images that are there are already good enough, but it's basically an emergency handbrake. Anyway, after this point, after it's installed the packages that it needs for the customer service, the machines are immutable. They really aren't changing for the duration of the lifetime of that node again. We do have the ability to manually go there and install stuff, but it's not really done ever. It's basically only for debugging purposes if we need to do something weird. Then the management agent starts up, which we call Prune, which is apparently some sort of plum tree or something. We came up with the name from somewhere, which I forget. Basically, what it does, it sets up the machine to operate the customer service. So sets up the disk layout with RAIDs and encryption, sets up all the cluster nodes talk to each other over IPv6 over IPsec. And then it basically restores the data of either from backups, which are often object stores, or then the other way around, they could be restoring the data from other nodes in the cluster, depending on the type of cluster that we're serving. And then it typically keeps on monitoring and reporting the health of the system. And there's also other ways of doing that, but it also keeps a general sense of the thing is still healthy and there's a heartbeat coming out of it. It also reacts to configuration changes. So when we add a new node, we need to create IPsec tunnels to those. We need to change cluster configuration and different database services. And then there's also the customers are allowed to change some configuration parameters in different services. So we allow users to configure some Postgres settings. So those, while the packages themselves are immutable, there's the data files on disk are obviously changing because, well, the database. The other thing is, of course, the configuration may change within those Postgres comms, but otherwise it's completely immutable. And then the management agent actually sets up a bunch of auxiliary agents. All of those run on the host side. There's basically some, we collect metrics. We collect metrics out of the system, and we collect tons and tons of metrics. So there's tons of data points coming out of those. Then we are shipping the logs from journal also in structured format. So we actually are able to search through those and we basically retain the structure of the logs that we basically put in there. And we also use structured logging for this. Then there are also backup and HA daemons like pghorde, which I mentioned, that are largely we've open sourced over time. The one we haven't is actually Cassandra's, and we're hoping to do that too. But when we implemented it, actually started relying on some of our internal things, and now we need to write it in a slightly different manner. Besides selling Apache Kafka as a service, we actually use it internally a lot. So we have tons and tons of Apache Kafka clusters. And we are basically all of these nodes and all of these daemons are actually talking to Kafka. And all the configuration changes coming from users are basically being sent over Kafka to these nodes. Okay. Then there's the container in those machines or nodes. It's basically run through a fairly locked down systemd and spawn. It basically contains only the customer user services, so things like Postgres or Apache Kafka or Elasticsearch or what have you. And none of these actually allow code execution. So it's actually like we haven't taken a single service type into use which would allow arbitrary user code execution. Basically, we are lacking like a really good sandbox for that. There's a couple of interesting ones like gVisor and like Firecracker that we've been looking at, but currently we don't allow any code execution. It's not that it's actually that bad if somebody actually managed to like get into their own machine. There's nothing that secret there, but it's just something that we'd rather people not shoot themselves in the foot with a foot gun. Anyway, after installation, the container again is totally immutable except for the config files, which may change, like Postgres conf, you may get the user options there, and we don't really want to rebuild the whole service again just to get like a new configuration switch that has different number in it, and the data files that the database itself is actually writing to. Then word about image building. So we support the six different cloud providers, and they all have a different way of for you to register new images and how you do this. Some like DigitalOcean actually only have pre-built images that you can only take snapshots of after you change them, so you can't actually upload your own images at all. So we basically had to make sure that our tooling works with all of them. Then. Some public clouds are fairly slow in when you're operating with them and creating like base images, and especially when you're transferring it to all the regions of that cloud provider. And the ways we do those are basically cloud dependent. There's nothing really shared between the clouds. They just have very differing implementations of how you do that. Anyway, now we have, I think it's like 89 cloud regions what we currently support among the six different public cloud vendors. Anyway, the pre-installed packages that we put on the images, some of them are actually fairly large, so they actually do take some disk space. But the idea behind this is that why we pre-install them and make the images themselves already contain this stuff is so that when we spin up a new node, which we do a lot, they basically are much faster ready to serve the customers and their needs. And then depending on the cloud provider, again, like things like Google are fairly fast and things like Azure are fairly slow in booting up. AWS being somewhere in the middle, they usually take somewhere between 2 minutes to 10 minutes from the time we call the API on the cloud provider side saying, please give me a VM with specs like X. Anyway, testing. Because we do a lot of these updates, so basically we follow Fedora's release cycle mostly, we basically have tons and tons of testing. We have unit tests, system tests, chaos tests, whatever kind of tests. But the thing is, oftentimes when we've actually hit problems, it hasn't been something that tests a particular version of something. It's actually just a generic test that starts failing, and then we go investigate it, and okay, it's because something changed somewhere. But it's if you want to do follow a fast-changing distribution, you really need like a fairly wide coverage test suite. That's my opinion, at least. Or otherwise, you're basically sailing blind. I'm not saying that our test suite couldn't be better. It could definitely be much, much better. But it's still has like found lots of different issues. The other thing is, with our approach, you're basically eating enduring quite a bit of pain all the time. But the other way around is if you do this every 3 years or 4 years or 5 years or whatever, what have you, there's basically a lot of pain when you actually do have to eventually move to the next version of the distro. So we'd rather have quite a bit of pain all the time instead of having an immense amount of pain every X years. And the other thing is that you really should be reading the release notes of everything with a magnifying glass. It hasn't always been smooth sailing. Recently, glibc changed their Unicode collations, and we got hit by this because we, while we were aware that it's changing, we weren't aware that Fedora had backported the change to the previous version of glibc. So that came as a bit of a surprise for us. It's something that we should have read with more carefully from the release notes, because it was definitely mentioned there. Then also IPsec in the kernel or in the tooling keeps on breaking all the time, which in 2019 I'd rather it actually just worked, but we still have issues. Of course, the other thing is we're using it on the public internet where the networks are not that great, which means that we're probably, we're, by the way, exposing a lot of these to an environment where they're typically not designed to be used. Originally, things like Apache Kafka were used in in-house data centers where the networks were stable and everything was good. In the public clouds, the networks aren't great, and you keep on having issues all the time by losing nodes or having net splits or whatnot. And then one of the other annoying things is that DNF is a bit on the slow side. Happily, there's going to be some improvements on this, but it's really also not really resilient against temporary network errors, so we actually use a wrapper around it. But in general, we're very happy with Fedora, and it's allowed us to actually focus on what we're doing instead of actually backporting stuff again. And it's also, basically, through the way we're doing this, it also forced us to de-emphasize the meaning of any single node. So we really, if a node gets lost, that's fine. The other thing is we basically just need to take care of persistence another way, because we don't really care about the particular nodes anymore. And if you want to do this, you really want to automate pretty much everything. Any questions? The first X questions get socks. So.
I want socks.
By the way, everybody who asks a question, come to me later and I'll find you the socks. There's.
We have some here.
Okay, well, there are people in the audience with socks.
Run-C and OCI structure, files, and also, that's my one question. Really,
we could use something like Run-C, but back in the day, it actually didn't exist.
How long ago was
2015.
This? 2015. Oh, okay.
So it didn't exist. And besides, I think actually systemd nspawn is actually trying to actually be able to run OCI directly. But on the other hand, what we're actually looking for next is actually better sandboxing rather than
My second question is what language is pruned written in, and are there any interesting mechanics in that orchestration piece?
It's actually written in Python, and it's written in Python. It does a lot of interesting orchestration, but it's also part of the proprietary secret sauce of ours. I mean, we're happy to open source a lot of the tools we're working on, but that's also some of the stuff that we actually do.
What's the database you choose to use for?
It actually doesn't use internally. It's basically run on every node. It doesn't have a database of its own, but what we use for our management things is actually Postgres. So I'm a longtime Postgres fan, and all the founders had written some small piece of code to Postgres back in the day. So we're heavily into Postgres.
So you picked Fedora for its release cycle, and because it was up to date, why not go even further?
And rawhide.
Yeah.
There's only so much pain that we can take. rawhide, back in the day, it used to be even wilder. These days, it's actually settled down, in my opinion. But you still have to draw a line somewhere. Any other questions? Okay. Or, okay.
How do you react to a host going down? Because if you use disk encryption, it can't, or I assume it can't come back on its own. Do you then just spin up a new host or node?
We typically spin up a new host once it's been unresponsive for X amount of time. They all send heartbeats over actually Kafka. We actually have fairly good idea when a node goes down. And we actively monitor for things like ACPI events. So if a cloud provider deems to actually, they actually want to tell us that the node is going away, we get like notice beforehand. Usually they don't, they just vanish. But some of them are nicer in this regard than others.
You mentioned gVisor. Do you use it? I mean, do you use it?
We've been looking at it. We don't currently use it, but it's something we've been looking actively at. Also, the Firecracker thing is another similar thing. The problem with Firecracker in our case is actually that you can't actually run it on other instances that aren't bare metal. So in the case of AWS, that sucks. In the case of GCP and Azure, they actually allow you to run things like KVM on KVM, but you can't do it on AWS.
Yeah, like the talk is mostly it's mostly about state management, and you solve the problem by having the application having some sort of clustering. Are there any other daemons that do not support clustering on their own, and you have some tooling to get the state from there and sync it with some other places?
Yes, so we, it's a fairly broad question, but yes, so yes, we do. Come talk to me after this if you want some more details.
Okay. You said you didn't use, that you used Lux. How do you deal with key management without using KMS services?
So for us, the keys are actually transient in the sense that they only have the lifecycle of the node. So once the node is gone, that's it. We don't go back to the nodes that are gone.
And would God include a reboot?
We don't actually. Even reboots, from our point of view, are basically the node is gone and we replace it. Yeah, so any other questions? I think I'm running over time.
Cutting into that, I assume that if you restart a node somewhere, then it also needs data. So how do you provision the initial data?
So it was here somewhere. But the answer is depends on the service type. And the question, in the case of Postgres, we typically restore everything from object store up until the point of the very latest data, and that we actually replicate from the other host in the cluster.
But if you provision from like an object store, then you need secrets or authentication or that kind of
yes,
stuff.
Yes, so all of this is encrypted. So basically, we do client-side encryption. We have the keys for the encrypted data in the object stores, obviously, and we basically just restore that. We use things like pghoard or myhoard or others like that. So those are all open source on GitHub. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's it. If you have any other questions, please find me after this. Thank you very much.